Good afternoon, everyone. It's, again, a pleasure to be here and with such a fine group. Being from Iowa, we're in the midst of our 15 minutes of fame every 4 years. You all are probably getting tired of us directing which candidates you get to vote for. And it's an interesting process. They say that to win or to even get a vote at the Iowa caucus, because the caucus, as you may be aware, is a very time-intensive, community-oriented process that you don't just go in, flip a lever, or check a box. You actually have to go and spend a good chunk of an evening there, that a person in Iowa has to shake hands with the person 3 times before they'll think about spending the time to go to the caucus with the person. So it really is an interesting component of this community orientation that we're talking about today. What I'm going to be talking about is from this community-oriented approach is really focusing more on the policy side of things rather than on the people side of things. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background on the Public Policy Center so you kind of get a sense of where I'm coming from, and then some examples of some of the research that we're doing and the different varying degrees of that policy and community engagement involved in those things. And then if we have time, I'd like to have a little bit of discussion about you about where that should be. And I think this is an interesting meeting for that, because APHA is made up almost by definition of a lot of people who are advocates for what they are doing. And that line for academic researchers and advocacy, I think, is a really interesting one and where that should be. So no disclosures to announce here. The Public Policy Center, our mission, and I took over as director of the center. I came there about 20 years ago to start the health policy research program, and that took over the center itself about 4 years ago. And our mission is now about providing policymakers with information to make their lives and communities thrive in sustainable ways through academic research. And this mission is obviously very broad, but the idea is that we have a whole variety of different policy areas in which we're doing research. So what is sort of that thread that goes across these or ties these things together? And the idea, the notion of sustainable communities is what we came up with. And sustainability often has sort of that greenness tone to it. But really, access to care and healthcare service availability and adequate workforce and all of those things, to me, is a really important component of having sustainable communities, whether it's economic development issues. Businesses aren't going to come in and set up and stay if you don't have adequate access to healthcare, et cetera. Same with environmental policy, housing and land use, human factors, vehicle safety, social science, transportation. So that's sort of the large umbrella. Organizationally, we're in the University Office of the Vice President for Research, so we're not in a college, and so by design, we're very interdisciplinary, and being in the Office of the Vice President for Research allows us to try to cross the university in a way that we really enjoy doing. From the health policy perspective, we do applied health services research, so we do studies on access to care, quality of care, costs of care. My particular interest probably of these is more in the access, but we do other areas. And in terms of oral health specifically, we look at oral health as one aspect of primary care. So a lot of the health policy research we do is broader, and I'll talk to you about specifically some of those projects. And that's one of the things 20-some years ago when I did my Robert Wood Johnson Health Services Research Training, that program was designed to get us outside of a dental school and work with a mentor who was not specifically in dentistry. I was fortunate to work with you, with Rick Brown, former APHA president, some of you know, who's also at UCLA, and we're actually continuing to do some work more recently. I've tied back together on some things. So the way I sort of look at being an advocate for oral health tangentially is by getting people to see oral health as reconnected to some broader issues. As everyone here well knows, we often separate the mouth from the body, et cetera. And so I hope in sort of a small way, by doing some research that is broad and has an oral health component, that we sort of bring that back together. Our funding for this, we're an externally funded university academic research center. We've got funding from both state, federal, and foundation sources, which is sort of nice from both a blend of stability, if you will, if one is up or down, but also because of the types of research we do, there's some of these sources of funding that are better or less good depending on what it is. And so 3 studies that I'm just going to mention to you here briefly that we're working on. One has to do with oral health disparities and factors related to a first preventive dental visit, and this is one that originally got us connected working with both initially Ruth and with Dave. That is what I would call the least direct policy oriented, but obviously because it's applied health services research has policy implications. The second is the Iowa Child and Family Household Health Survey, which is one that we do with our State Department of Public Health, and actually led to the National Child Health Study that you might be aware of that goes on. So that one has sort of broader policy implications, and then one we're doing right now that's funded by the Commonwealth Fund, looking at the impact of the Affordable Care Act on safety net providers using Iowa as a model for the country. And I'll walk through these and sort of the level of policy engagement and how there's different levels, but I think they're all important in that way. So the first one with our oral health disparities in children's study, this is one, as I mentioned, funded by NODCR, that's studying factors related to first preventive dental visit from a variety of different factors. One of my colleagues, Donald Chi, is here, who's actively involved in that study. And we're using Iowa Medicaid claims and enrollment files as well as consumer surveys to look at different aspects of that. And the focus of this is on dental access and care utilization and how important is the time at which the children receive that first preventive dental visit on subsequent dental use and what types of services and costs. And it's a combination of things with community health centers as well as those that are out in the community. So there's four components of this. The first one is the one that Donald is taking a leave on about the determinants of the age at first preventive dental visit, and one of the interesting outside of dentistry aspects that he's focusing on is the impact of well-child visits, and we'd all like to think that we can get people outside of the dental team, the oral health team involved, and he's looking at, well, how much of an impact does that have on the age at which a child receives that first visit? The second one with my colleague Ray Kuthi, who many of you know from his long dental public health career, is on the effectiveness of the age at first preventive dental visit on subsequent dental and medical costs. I'm sorry, actually his is, we talk about these in a different order. His is actually number three, which is the age at first preventive dental visit and successful treatment completion, and he's focusing on care received at community health centers. And many of you involved in that, and there, as you well know, there's not a lot of data actually for community health centers and what's going on. And in terms of the particular question that we were interested in is that the age that a child is first seen there, and then this was a combination of chart audits as well as claims data, and then looking at did they get everything that was in that initial treatment plan completed. And so this one, I think, is a really interesting one, and it's a little bit more descriptive, but I think it really fits an important component. The second one, now third, is on the effectiveness at age at first preventive dental visit and subsequent cost issues. And a health economist at our College of Public Health by the name of George Webby is a person that's taking the lead on that, and that is all claims data driven. And then the fourth is our behavioral scientist, by the name of Natasha Askelson, who is very good and a part of our team, and we're looking at maternal decision making, and that's a combination of some claims data, but also surveying mothers about their knowledge and attitudes about the time at which a child should receive that first dental visit. So in terms of the level of policy engagement for this one, since we're using mostly claims and enrollment, but some survey data, in terms of the data analysis or the data component, not as much, but we are doing the surveying of the Department of Human Services and the clients, getting feedback from the Department of Human Services about access, and we're feeding more of that information to them. But since this wasn't done at their request, what we found is if we start the process or it's something that they're interested in at the beginning, you get a little bit more buy-in. So while we'd be getting this information and feeding it back to them, whether they will have enough buy-in to actually think about doing anything different with it, we'll see. The second one, and this one came from a more engaged process with our State Department of Public Health, is this Child and Family Household Health Survey, which we conduct every 5 years. We're in the midst of beginning the analysis for the third one. We did one in 2000, 2005, and then 2010-11. And it's a population-based household health survey, and we've interviewed 2,400 families with children. We changed the methodology this year, so if any of you are interested in survey methodology kinds of things, we're using an address-based sampling approach to try to get away from some of the problems of cell phone use and some of the other things, and be happy to talk with you about some of those things that we found with that. We have a separate oversample of that of minority children in Iowa to try to look at. We have a health disparities component of that specifically and do a report on that every year. And the survey itself was developed through a very interactive process with different bureaus within the Department of Public Health. So we've got had nutrition components and working with the Nutrition Bureau and physical activity components, working with the physical activity people. And so they've been engaged, and the Oral Health Bureau has been involved with the oral health questions. And so this is one of those where we're bringing oral health and dentistry in as one aspect of primary care and engaging the policymakers directly in the development of the instrument. And then we'll feed this back at various meetings and through reports and policy briefs and things like that. So from a policy engagement, you know, pretty much what I was just sharing with you in terms of how this is a little bit higher level of engagement than a traditional NIH NIDCR type of study. The third one, which is really the most engaged of the work that we've probably ever done at the center, is a study of the ACA and related delivery system changes on the Iowa Safety Net. And the Commonwealth Fund was very interested in this question, and don't have to talk to you about the importance of the safety net in all of these discussions, but as you also are well aware, that 20% is often forgotten because there's such big issues going on related to the ACA. Commonwealth Fund wanted to make sure that they weren't forgotten, so they funded four different projects, three of them looking at a national level, and then ours is using Iowa to look at these questions as a state and local model for looking at changes in financing and delivery and patient mix. And so to do that, we've created a whole series of advisory committees. And one of the reasons that we were able to do this in Iowa is because there was already the Iowa Safety Net Network in place. So there was a state legislatively mandated and funded group that's been in place for about 4 years. So you already had about 30 or 35 different organizations around the table representing different aspects of the safety net in Iowa. So that was one of the things that the Commonwealth Fund thought was very appealing. We didn't have to say, yeah, we'll get all these people together. We can say they're already together, we're going to enhance it, and sort of be able to prove that we could do something with it. The focus of this is on primary care, but obviously you can't just focus on primary care. You have to focus on referrals and some things like that as well as a part of that. And looking at to do this, we've got different levels of advisory committees. So we have a leadership group, which represents about 20 that we meet with almost every month. We've got a steering committee that actually meets weekly. Then we've got a state advisory group that meets every other month, and that's 65 different members from all the different healthcare associations, safety net providers, federally qualified health centers, rural health centers, family planning clinics, free clinics, as well as Department of Human Services, Department of Public Health, all of those kinds of people, as well as some people from the legislature and consumers. And those are who we added in to the group that they had in place to round out the picture for what we wanted to do. And you might think it's a very unwieldy size of a group to manage, and to be honest, I had a lot of concerns going into this process, but it's been one of the best group process, and I'm sure all of you have been involved in lots of those over the years. This has been a great one. Get in front of this group of 60 people, and what we're doing is we're doing an inventory of all of the different financing and delivery of safety net, and we're defining safety net in this project as, again, federally qualified health centers, rural health clinics, free clinics, family planning clinics, and community-based mental health and substance abuse clinics. And then from a payer perspective, we're looking at Medicare, Medicaid, CHIP, public health block grants, and Ryan White. And so our team is doing an inventory of these things, presenting this back to the group, and getting guidance from them. In addition, we've got a group of eight national advisory committee members from RAND and Harvard and the National Academy for State Health Policy and Rural Health Clinic Association, the Community Health Center Association, and then they're also helping to sort of guide this process. So in the end, what we're hoping to be able to do, and this all assumes, of course, that there aren't going to be any changes either related to a Supreme Court decision or an election or whatever else, and that's all we can sort of be working under, but what are the things that you might want to be thinking about, and we're doing this as advising the safety net providers in the state. So where might some of the changes in financing be coming from or affecting? Where might the populations go? What are some things, if you're going to set up an accountable care organization between a health system and a community health center, what are the things that you might have to think about? Cost-based reimbursement is a big issue, as many of you are aware. So how do you work out that issue of a cost-based reimbursement system that can be competitive to be a part of an ACO, or can you? Or are you going to have to give that up and do something different? So those are the kinds of things to look at, coordination and collaboration between the public and private sectors. And this is just an example of a variety of the other kinds of things that we've been involved in. So I think then this just sort of gets back to that issue. So what should our role be? And, you know, you could look at it in different levels, I think. The first is that our job is to create knowledge that can inform policymakers, you know, if they seek it out. So, for example, just do traditional academic research, public things in journal, and, you know, and if they're aggressive enough to go out and find it, great. You know, the second, I think we all know that's not real likely, but it happens. The second is that you can inform policymakers by making the research more accessible. So policy briefs and things like that, and we will often publish our things twice. We'll publish them in academic journals, we'll publish them in reports or briefs to try to, you know, facilitate and make that easier. Does it work? You know, again, somewhat to some extent. And then there's that interacting directly. And we'll often do that, get involved, everything from testimony to the legislature to just presenting to different groups or personal meetings that they'll ask for information. We do that frequently with our Department of Public Health and Human Services people. And then the last is that advocating for change part. And from my perspective, that's where that sort of line then comes in, is not to try to cross to the, as an academic researcher, is not to try to cross that line to being an advocate, because as soon as we do, then we risk all of the data and all of the research we're doing being seen as advocacy and biased, and, well, you're a child health advocate, or you're interested in disparities, or whatever it might be, and so the people that don't want to listen to it will automatically dismiss it. And then what the hope would be is that we would get that information to folks here in the room and other policymakers who then can take that and advocate for it. But obviously that's not a hard and fast rule. That line is very gray. That line varies depending on what the project is and what the question is and all those kinds of things. And so it's an interesting dilemma, if you will, to some extent, but it's also a lot of fun, and it allows us to do academic research that hopefully is a little bit more applied, a little bit more useful, and might actually, you know, do some good. So thanks.